A riot of protests, appeals, and supplications filled the council chambers. Richard stood, and the voices fell to silence. The Sandarian ambassador lifted a bony finger in accusation.
"You are a ruthless man,"
Richard nodded, the magic heating his glare. "Be sure to tell that to the Imperial Order if you choose to join with them." He looked down on the other faces. "You all had peace and unity through the council and the Mother Confessor. While she was away fighting for you and your people, you threw that unity aside for ambition, for naked greed. You acted like children fighting over a cake. You had a chance to share it, but instead chose to try to steal it all from your smaller siblings. If you come to my table, you will have to mind your manners, but you each will have bread." No one offered an argument this time. Richard straightened his wrist-width cape on his shoulders when he realized Catherine had finished signing and was watching him with those big brown eyes. He couldn't maintain the grip on the sword's anger and the glow of her sweet gaze. He turned back to the representatives, the rage gone from his tone. "The weather is clear. You had best be off. The sooner you convince your leaders to agree to my terms, the less inconvenience your people will suffer. I don't want anyone to suffer." His voice trailed off. Catherine stood next to him and looked down at the people she knew so well.
"Do as Lord Rawl asks. He has given you enough of his time."
She turned and addressed one of her aides.
"Have my clothes brought over at once. I'll be staying here, at the Confessor's Palace."
"Why is she staying here?" one of the ambassadors asked as his brow wrinkled in suspicion. "Her husband, as you know, was killed by Imriswith," Richard said. "She is staying here for protection."
"You mean there is danger for us?"
"Very possibly," Richard said. "Her husband was an expert swordsman, yet he... Well, I hope you will be careful. If you join with us, then you are entitled to be guests of the palace and the protection of my magic. There are plenty of empty guest rooms, but they will remain empty until you surrender." Accompanied by worried chatter, they headed for the doors.
"Shall we go?"
Catherine asked in a breathy voice. His task done, Richard felt the sudden emptiness being filled with her presence. As she took his arm and they started away, he summoned the last shred of his will to stop at the end of the dais, where Ulic and Kara were standing. "Keep us in sight at all times, understand?"
"Yes, Lord Rawl,"
Ulic and Kara said as one. Catherine tugged on his arm, urging his ear close.
"Richard,"
her warm breath carrying his name sent a shudder of longing through him.
"You said we would be alone. I want to be alone with you. Very alone. Please."
It was from this moment that Richard had borrowed strength. He could no longer hold the image of the sword in his mind. In desperation, he put Kaelin's face there in its stead.
"There is danger about, Catherine. I can sense it. I won't risk your life carelessly. When I don't feel the danger, then we can be alone. Please try to understand for now."
She looked distraught, but nodded.
"For now."
As they stepped off the platform, Richard's gaze snagged on Kara's.
"Don't let us out of your sight for anything."
Chapter 24 Phoebe plopped down the reports in a narrow, vacant spot on the polished walnut table.
"Verna, may I ask you a personal question?"
Verna scrawled her initials across the bottom of a report from the kitchens, requesting replacements for the large cauldrons that had burned through.
"We've been friends for a good long time, Phoebe. You may ask me anything you wish."
She again scrutinized the request, and then above her initials she wrote a note, denying permission and telling them to instead have the cauldrons repaired. Verna reminded herself to show a smile.
"Ask."
Phoebe's round cheeks flushed as she twisted her fingers together.
"Well, I mean no offense, but you're in a unique position, and I could never ask anyone else but a friend like you."
She cleared her throat.
"What's it like to get old?"
Verna snorted a laugh. "We're the same age, Phoebe." She wiped her palms at the hips of her green dress as Verna waited.
"Yes, but you've been away for more than 20 years. You've aged that much, just like those outside the palace. It will take me near to 300 years to age to where you are right now. Why, you look like a woman of almost 40.
Verna sighed.
"Yes, well, a journey will do that to you. At least mine did." "I don't want to ever go on a journey and get old. Does it hurt or something to so suddenly be old? Do you feel, I don't know, like you're not attractive and life is no longer sweet? I like it when men view me as desirable. I don't want to get old like..."
It worries me.
Verna pushed away from the table and leaned back in her chair. Her strongest urge was to strangle the woman, but she took a breath and reminded herself that it was a friend's sincere question asked out of ignorance.
I would guess that everyone views it in their own unique way, but I can tell you what it means for me. Yes, it hurts a bit, Phoebe, to know that something is gone and can never be recovered, as if I was somehow not paying attention and my youth was stolen from me while I was waiting for my life to start. But the Creator balances it with good, too.
Good? What good could come of it?
Well, inside I'm still myself, but wiser. I find that I have a clearer understanding of myself and what I want. I appreciate things I never did before. I see better what's really important in doing the Creator's work. I suppose you could say I feel more content and worry less about what others think of me. Even though I've aged, that doesn't diminish my longing for others. I find comfort in friends, and yes, to answer what you're thinking, I still long for men, much the same as I always did. But now I have a wider appreciation for them. I find callow youth less interesting. Men need not simply be young to stir my feelings, and the simple hold less appeal. Phoebe's eyes were wide as she leaned forward attentively.
Really? Older men stir longings in you?
Verna checked her tongue. What I meant by older, Phoebe, was men older like me. The men that catch your interest now? 50 years ago, you wouldn't have considered walking with a man the age you are now, but now it seems natural to you because you're that age. And men now the age you were back then seem immature to you. See what I mean?
Well, I guess.
Verna could read it in her eyes that she didn't.
When we first came here as young girls, like the two down in the vaults last night, novices Helen and Valerie, what did you think of women who were the age you are now?
Phoebe covered a giggle with her hand.
I thought them impossibly old. I never thought I'd be this age.
And now, how do you feel about your age?
Oh, it isn't old at all. I guess I was just foolish at that young age. I like being this age. I'm still young.
Verna shrugged.
It's much the same for me. I view myself in much the way you view yourself. I no longer see older people as simply old, because I now know that they're the same as you or I. They view themselves the same as you or I view ourselves.
The young woman wrinkled her nose.
I guess I see what you mean, but I still don't want to get old.
Phoebe, in the outside world, you would have lived nearly 3 lives by now. We have been given a great gift by the Creator, to be able to have as many years as we do, living here at the palace, in order to have the time necessary to train young wizards in their gift. Appreciate what you were given. It's a rare benevolence that touches only a handful.
Phoebe nodded slowly, and behind the slight squint, Verna could almost see the labor of contemplative reasoning.
That's very wise, Verna. I never knew you were so wise. I always knew you were smart, but you never seemed wise to me before.
Verna smiled.
That's one of the other advantages. Those younger than you think you wise. In a land of the blind, a one-eyed woman could be queen.
But it seems so frightening to have your flesh go limp and wrinkly.
It happens gradually. You become somewhat accustomed to yourself growing older. To me, the thought of being your age again seems frightening.
Why's that?
Verna wanted to say that it was because she feared walking around with such an underdeveloped intellect, but she reminded herself once again that she and Phoebe had shared a good part of their lives as friends.
Oh, I guess because I've been through some of the thorn hedges you have yet to face, and I know their sting.
What sort of thorns?
I think they're different for each person. Everyone has to walk her own path.
Phoebe wrung her hands as she leaned over even more.
What were the thorns on your path, Verna?
Verna stood and pushed the stopper back into the ink bottle. She stared down at her desk, not seeing it.
I guess, she said in a distant tone, the worst was returning to have Jedediah look at me with eyes like yours, eyes that saw a wrinkled, dried-up, old, unattractive hag.
Oh, please, Verna, I never meant to suggest that.
Do you even understand the thorn in that, Phoebe?
Why, to be thought old and ugly, of course, even though you are not that.
Verna shook her head.
No.
She looked up into the other's eyes.
No, the thorn was to discover that appearance was all that ever mattered.
And that what was inside, she tapped the side of her head,
didn't hold any meaning for him, only its wrapping.
Even worse than returning to see that look in Jedediah's eyes, though, was to discover that he had given himself over to the Keeper. In order to save Richard's life, as Jedediah was about to kill him, Verna had buried her Dacra in his back. Jedediah had betrayed not only her, but the Creator, too. A part of her had died with him. Phoebe straightened, looking a bit puzzled.
"Yes, I guess I know what you mean. When men..."
Verna waved her hand in a dismissive gesture.
"I hope I've been of help, Phoebe. It's always good to talk to a friend."
Her voice took on the clear ring of authority.
"Are there any petitioners to see me?"
Phoebe blinked.
"Petitioners? No, not today."
"Good. I wish to go pray and seek the Creator's guidance. Would you and Dulcinea please shield the door? I wish not to be disturbed." Phoebe curtsied.
"Of course, prelate."
She smiled warmly.
"Thank you for the talk, Verna. It was like old times in our room after we were ordered to be sleeping."
Her gaze darted to the stacks of papers.
"But what about the reports? They're falling further behind."
"As prelate, I cannot ignore the light that directs the palace and the sisters. I must also pray for us and ask for his guidance. We are, after all, the sisters of the light." A look of awe returned to Phoebe's eyes. Phoebe seemed to believe that in assuming the post, Verna had somehow become more than human and could somehow touch the hand of the Creator in a miraculous way.
"Of course, prelate. I will see to the placement of the shield. No one will disturb the prelate's meditation."
Before Phoebe went through the door, Verna called her name in a quiet tone.
"Have you learned anything yet about Christabel?"
Phoebe's eyes turned away in sudden disquiet.
"No. No one knows where she went. We've had no word on where Amelia or Janet have disappeared to either."
The five of them, Christabel, Amelia, Janet, Phoebe, and Verna, had been friends, had grown up together at the palace, but Verna had been closest to Christabel, though they were all a bit jealous of her. The Creator had blessed her with gorgeous blonde hair and comely features, but also with a kind and warm nature. It was disturbing that her three friends seemed to have vanished. Sisters sometimes left the palace for visits home while their families were still living, but they requested permission first, and besides, the families of those three would have all passed away of old age long ago. Sisters, too, sometimes went away for a time, not only to refresh their minds in the outside world, but also to simply have a break from decade upon decade at the palace. Even then, they almost always would tell the others that they had to leave for a time and where they were going. None of her three friends had done that. They had simply shown up missing after the prelate died. Verna's heart ached with the worry that they simply couldn't accept her as prelate and had chosen instead to leave the palace. But as much as it hurt, she prayed it was that and not something darker that had taken them.
"If you hear anything, Phoebe," Verna said, trying to hide her concern, "please come tell me."
After the woman had gone, Verna placed her own shield inside the doors, a telltale shield she had devised herself, the delicate filaments spun from the spirit of her own unique Han, magic she would recognize as her own. Should anyone try to enter, they probably wouldn't detect the diaphanous shield and would tear the fragile threads. Even if they did manage to detect it, their mere presence and the act of probing for a shield would still unavoidably tear it, and if they then repaired the weave with Han of their own, Verna would know that, too. Hazy sunlight filtered through the trees near the garden wall, infusing the quiet wooded area of the retreat with a muted, dreamy light. The small woodlot ended at a clump of sweet bay, their branches heavy with hairy white buds. The trail beyond meandered into a well-tended patch of blue and yellow flowering ground cover, surrounding islands of taller lace lady ferns and monarch roses. Verna broke a twig off one of the sweet bays and idly savored its spicy aroma as she surveyed the wall while striding along the path. At the rear of the plantings stood a thicket of shining sumac, the ribbon of small trees placed deliberately to screen the high wall protecting the prelate's garden and give the illusion of more expansive grounds. She eyed the squat trunks and spreading branches critically. They might do if nothing better could be found. She moved on. She was already late. On a small side trail around the backside of the wild place where the prelate's sanctuary stood hidden, she found a promising spot. Once she had lifted her dress and stepped through the shrubs to reach the wall, she could see that it was perfect. Sheltered all around by pine was a sunlit area where pear trees had been espaliered against the wall. While they were all trained and pruned, one seemed to be particularly suitable. Its limbs to each side alternated like the steps of a single-pole ladder. Just before Verna hiked her skirts up and started to climb, the texture of the bark caught her eye. She rubbed a finger along the top edge of stout limbs. Seeing that they were calloused and rough, it would appear she was not the first prelate to want to surreptitiously depart the prelate's compound. Once she had climbed atop the wall and had checked that no guards were in sight, she found there was a convenient abutment to a reinforcing pilaster to step down on, and then a drain tile, and then a decorative stone sticking out, and then a low-spreading limb of a smoky oak, and then a round rock not 2 feet from the wall, and an easy hop to the ground. She brushed off the bark and leaves, and then straightened her gray dress at the hips, and ordered the simple collar. She slipped the prelate's ring into a pocket. As she draped her heavy black shawl over her head and tied it under her chin, Verna grinned with the thrill of having found a secret way to escape her prison of paper. She was surprised to find the palace grounds uncommonly deserted. Guards patrolled their posts, and sisters, novices, and young men in collars dotted the paths and stoned walkways as they went about their business, but there were few city people to be seen, most of them old women. Every day, during the daylight hours, people from the city of Tanimura poured across the bridges to Halsband Island to seek advice from the sisters, to petition for intervention in disputes, to request charity, to seek guidance in the Creator's wisdom, and to worship in the courtyards all over the island. Why they would think they needed to come here to worship had always seemed odd to Verna, but she knew these people viewed the home of the Sisters of the Light as hallowed ground. Perhaps they simply enjoyed the beauty of the palace grounds. They weren't enjoying it now. There were virtually no city people to be seen. Novices assigned to guide visitors paced in boredom. Guards at the gates to restricted areas chatted among themselves, and those who glanced her way saw only another sister going about her business. The lawns were empty of reposing guests. The formal gardens displayed their beauty to no one, and the fountains sprayed and splashed without the accompaniment of astonished gasps from adults or delighted squeals from children. Even the gossip benches sat vacant. In the distance, the drums beat on. Verna found Warren sitting on the dark, flat rock at their meeting place in the rushes on the city side of the river. He was skipping stones out onto the swirling waters, prowled by one lone fishing boat. Warren jumped up when he heard her approach.
"Verna, I didn't know if you were ever going to come."
Verna watched the old man bait his hooks as his skiff rolled gently beneath his steady legs.
"Phoebe wanted to know what it was like to get old and wrinkled."
Warren brushed dirt from the seat of his violet robes.
"Why would she ask you?"
Verna only sighed at his blank expression.
"Let's get going."
The journey through the city toward the outskirts proved as strange as the palace grounds. While some of the shops in the wealthy sections were open and doing a bit of trade with a scattering of people, the market in the indigent section was vacant, its tables empty, cook fires cold, and shop windows shuttered. The lean-to shelters were deserted, the looms in the workshops abandoned, and the streets silent but for the constant grating presence of the drums. Warren acted as if there was nothing unusual about the ghostly streets. As the two of them turned down a narrow, deeply shadowed, dusty street lined with dilapidated buildings, Verna had had enough and finally erupted in fury.
"Where is everyone? What's going on?"
Warren stopped and turned to give her a puzzled look as she stood, fists on hips, in the center of the empty street.
"It's Jala Day."
She fixed him with a scowl.
"Jala Day?"
He nodded, the puzzled frown deepening.
"Yes, Jala Day.
What did you think happened to all the—" Warren slapped his forehead.
"I'm sorry, Verna. I thought you knew. We've become so accustomed to it, I just forgot you wouldn't know."
Verna folded her arms.
"Know what?"
Warren returned to take her arm and start her walking again.
"Jala is a game, a contest."
He pointed over his shoulder.
"They built a big playing field in the bowl between two hills on the outskirts of the city, over that way, about, oh, I guess it must have been 15 or 20 years ago, when the emperor came to rule. Everyone loves it."
"A game? The entire city empties out to go watch a game?" Warren nodded.
"I'm afraid so, except a few, mostly older people. They don't understand it and aren't too interested, but most everyone else is. It's become the people's passion. Children start playing it in the streets almost as soon as they can walk."
Verna eyed a side street and checked hind the way they had come.
"What kind of game is this?"
Warren shrugged.
"I've never been to an official game, yet. I spend most of my time down in the vaults, but I've delved into the subject a bit. I've always been interested in games and how they fit into the structure of different cultures. I've studied ancient peoples and their games, but this gives me the chance to observe a living game for myself, so I've read up on it and made inquiries. Jala is played by two teams on a square Jala field, marked out with grids. In each corner is a goal, two for each team. The teams try to put the brak, a heavy, leather-covered ball a little smaller than a man's head, in one of their opponent's goals. If they do, then they get a point, and the other team gets to pick a grid square from which they begin their turn at attack. I don't understand the strategy. It gets complex, but five-year-olds seem to be able to grasp it in no time.
Probably because they want to play and you don't.
Berna untied her shawl and flapped the ends, trying to cool her neck.
What's so interesting about it that everyone would want to go crowd together in the sun to see it?
I guess it takes them away from their toil for a day of festivity, gives them an excuse to cheer and scream and to drink and celebrate if their team wins, or to drink and console one another if their team loses. Everyone gets quite worked up over it, more worked up than they should.
Berna thought it over a moment as she felt a refreshing breeze cool her neck.
Well, I guess that sounds harmless. Warren glanced over out of the corner of his eye.
It's a bloody game.
Bloody? Warren sidestepped a pile of dung.
The ball is heavy and the rules loose. The men who play Jala are savage. While they must, of course, be adept at handling the brak, they're selected mostly because of their brawn and their brutal aggressiveness. Not many a game goes by without at least some teeth getting knocked out or a broken bone. It isn't rare for a neck to get broken either.
Berna stared incredulously.
And people like to watch that.
Warren grunted a humorless confirmation.
From what the guards tell me, the crowd gets ugly if there isn't blood, because they think it means their team isn't trying hard enough.
Berna shook her head.
Well, it doesn't sound like anything I would enjoy watching.
That isn't the worst of it. Warren kept his eyes ahead as he strode along the shadowed street. To the sides, shutters so faded it was hard to tell they had ever been painted, stood closed over narrow windows.
The losing team is brought out onto the field when the game is over, and each is flogged, one lash with a big leather whip for each point scored against them, administered by the winning team. And the rivalry between teams is bitter. It isn't unheard of for men to die from the flogging.
Berna walked in stunned silence as they turned a corner.
The people stay for this flogging?
I think that's what they go for. The entire crowd supporting the winning team counts out the number of lashes as they're laid on. Emotions run pretty high. People get really worked up over Jala. Sometimes there are riots. Even with 10,000 troops trying to keep order, things can get out of hand. The players sometimes start the brawl. The men who play Jala are brutes.
People really like rooting for a team of brutes.
The players are heroes. Jala players virtually have the run of the city and can do no wrong. Rules and laws rarely apply to Jala players. Crowds of women follow the players around, and after a game there's usually a team orgy. Women fight over who will be with a Jala player. The spree goes on for days. To have been with a player is an honor of the highest order, and is so highly contested that bragging rights require witnesses.
Why?
Was all she could think to say. Warren threw up his hands.
You're a woman, you tell me. When I've been the first in 3,000 years to solve a prophecy, I've never had a woman throw her arms around my neck or want to lick the blood off my back.
They do that. Fight over it. If he's pleased with her tongue, he might pick her. I hear the players are pretty arrogant and like to make the eager women earn the honor of being under him.
Berna looked over and saw that Warren's face was glowing red.
They even want to be with the losing players.
It's irrelevant. He's a Jala player, a hero. The more brutal, the better. The ones who have killed an opponent with a Jala ball are renowned, and are most sought after by the women. People name babies after them. I just don't understand it.
You're just seeing a small sampling of people, Warren. If you were to go into the city instead of spending all your time down in the vaults, women would want to be with you too.
He tapped his bare neck.
They would if I still had a collar, because they would see the palace's gold around my neck, that's all. They wouldn't want to be with me because of who I am.
Berna pursed her lips.
Some people are attracted by power. When you have no power yourself, it can be very seductive. That's just the way life is.
Life, he repeated with a sour grunt.
Jala is what everyone calls it, but its full name is Jala de Jin, the game of life. In the old tongue of the Emperor's homeland of Alterang, but everyone simply calls it Jala, the game.
What does Altarang mean?
Altarang is from their old tongue, too. It doesn't translate well, but it means approximately the Creator's Chosen, or Destiny's People, something like that.
Why?
The New World is split by a mountain range called Rang Shada. It sounds like the same language.
Warren nodded.
A Shada is an armored war gauntlet with spikes. Rang Shada would roughly mean War Fist of the Chosen.
A name from the old war, I guess.
Spikes would certainly apply to those mountains. Verna's head was still spinning with Warren's story.
I can't believe this game is allowed.
Allowed? It's encouraged. The Emperor has his own personal Jala team. It was announced this morning that when he comes for his visit, he's going to bring his team to play Tanamura's top team. Quite an honor, from what I gather, as everyone is beside themselves with excitement at the prospect.
Warren glanced around and then turned back to her again.
The Emperor's team doesn't get flogged if they lose.
She lifted an eyebrow.
The privilege of the mighty?
Not exactly, Warren said.
If they lose, they get beheaded.
Verna's hands dropped away from the points of her shawl.
Why would such a game be encouraged by the Emperor?
Warren smiled a private smile.
I don't know, Verna, but I have my theories.
Such as?
Well, if you have conquered a land, what problems do you suppose might present themselves?
You mean insurrection? Warren brushed back a lock of his curly blonde hair.
Turmoil, protests, civil unrest, riots, and yes, insurrection.
Do you remember when King Gregory ruled? Verna nodded as she watched an old woman far up a side street draping wet clothes over a balcony railing. It was the only person she had seen in the last hour.
What happened to him?
Not long after you left. The Imperial Order took over, and that was the last we heard of him. The king was well thought of, and Tanimura prospered, along with the other cities under his rule in the north. Since then, times have become hard for the people. The emperor allowed corruption to flourish, and at the same time ignored important matters of commerce and justice. All those people you've seen living in squalor are refugees come to Tanimura from smaller towns, villages, and cities that were sacked. They seem a quiet and content lot for refugees. An eyebrow lifted over a blue eye.
Jala.
What do you mean? They have little hope of a better life under the Imperial Order. The one thing they can have hope for, dream about, is to become a Jala player. The players are selected because of their talent at the game, not because they have rank or power. The family of a player need never want for anything again. He can provide for them in abundance. Parents encourage their children to play Jala, hoping they will become paid players. Amateur teams, classed by age group, start with 5-year-olds. Anyone, no matter their background, can become a paid Jala player. Players have even come from the ranks of the Emperor's slaves. But that still doesn't explain the passion for it. Everyone is part of the Imperial Order now. No devotion to one's former land is allowed. Jala lets people be devoted to something, to their neighbors, to their city, through their team. The Emperor paid to have the Jala field built, a gift to the people. The people are distracted from the conditions of their lives, over which they have no control, and into an outlet that doesn't threaten the Emperor. Verna flapped the ends of her shawl again.
I don't think your theory casts a shadow, Warren. From a young age, children like to play games. They do it all day. People have always played games. When they get older, they have contests with the bow, with horses, with dice. It's part of human nature to play at games.
This way, Warren caught her sleeve and pointed with a thumb, turning her down a narrow alley.
And the Emperor is channeling that tendency into something more than natural. He need not worry about their minds wandering to thoughts of their freedom or even simple matters of justice. Their passion now is Jala. Their minds are dulled to everything else. Instead of wondering why the Emperor is coming and what it will mean for their lives, everyone is aflutter because of Jala.
Verna felt her stomach lurch. She had been wondering just why the Emperor was coming. There had to be a reason for him to come all this way, and she didn't think it was just to watch his team play Jala. He wanted something.
Aren't the people worried about defeating such a powerful man, or his team, anyway?
The Emperor's team is very good, I'm told, but they don't have any special privilege or advantage. The Emperor takes no affront at his team losing, except, of course, with his players. If an opponent bests them, the Emperor will acknowledge their skill and heartily congratulate them and their city. People long for that honor, to best the Emperor's renowned team.
I've been back for a couple months, and I've never seen the city empty out for this game before.
Well, the season just started.
Official games are only allowed to be played in the Jala season.
That doesn't fit with your theory, then. If the game is a distraction from more important matters of life, why not let them play it all the time?
Roran gave her a smug smile.
Anticipation makes the fervor stronger.
The prospects for the upcoming season are talked about endlessly. By the time the season finally arrives, the people are worked up into a fever pitch, like young lovers returned to the embrace after an absence. Their minds are dull to anything else. If the game went on all the time, the ardor might cool.
Warren had obviously thought long and hard on his theory. She didn't think she believed in it, but he seemed to have an answer for everything, so she changed the subject.
Where did you hear this about him bringing his team?
Master Finch.
Warren, I sent you to the stables to find out about those horses, not to gab about Jala.
Master Finch is a big Jala enthusiast, and was all excited about today's opening game, so I let him ramble on about it so I could find out what you wanted to know.
And did you?
They came to an abrupt halt, looking up at a carved sign displaying a headstone, shovel, and the names Benstent and Sproul.
Yes. Between telling me how many lashes the other team was going to get and telling me how to make money betting on the outcome, he told me that the missing horses have been gone for quite a time.
Since right after winter solstice, I'd bet. Warren shielded his eyes with a hand as he peered into the window.
You'd win the bet. Four of his strongest horses, but full tack for only two, are gone. He's still searching for the horses and swears he'll find them, but he thinks the tack was stolen.
From behind the door in the back of the dark room, she could hear the sound of a file on steel.
Warren took his hand from his face and checked the street.
Sounds like there's someone here who isn't a Jala enthusiast.
Good.
Verna tied the shawl under her chin and then pulled open the door.
Let's go hear what this gravedigger has to say.
Chapter 25.
Only the small street-side window coated with ancient layers dirt and an open door in the back lit the dim, dusty room, but it was enough to see a path through the cluttered mounds of sloppy rolls of winding sheets, rickety workbenches, and simple coffins. A few rusty saws and planes hung on one wall, and a disorderly stack of pine planks leaned against another. While people of means frequented undertakers who provided guidance in the selection of ornate, expensive coffins for their loved ones, people with precious little money could afford no more than the services of simple grave diggers, who supplied a plain box and a hole to put it in. While the departed loved ones of those who came to grave diggers were no less precious to them, they had to worry about feeding the living. Their memories of the deceased, however, were no less gilded. Verna and Warren paused at the doorway out into a tiny pit of a workyard, its borders steep and high with lumber stacked upright against a fence to the back and stuccoed buildings at each side. In the center, with his back to them, a gangly, barefoot man in tattered clothes stood facing away from them as he filed the blades of his shovels.
"My condolences on the loss of your loved one," he said in a gravelly but surprisingly sincere voice.
He resumed drawing the file against the steel.
"Child or adult?"
"Neither," Verna said. The hollow-cheeked man glanced back over his shoulder. He wore no beard but looked as if his efforts at shaving were rare enough that he was close to crossing the line.
"In between, then, if you'll tell me the size of the departed, I can work a box to fit."
Verna clasped her hands. "We've no one to bury. We're here to ask you some questions."
He quieted his hands and turned around fully to look them up and down.
"Well, I can see that you can afford more than me."
"You aren't interested in Jala?" Warren asked. The man's droopy eyes came a little more alert as he took another look at Warren's violet robes.
"Folks don't fancy the likes of me around at festive occasions. Spoils their good time to look on my face, like it were the face of death itself walking among 'em. Aren't shy about telling me I'm not welcome either. But they come by when they've need of me. They come then, and act like they never turned their eyes away before. I could let 'em go pay for a fancy box, what the dead won't see, but they can't afford it, and their coin don't do me no good if I grudge 'em their fears."
"Which are you?" Verna asked. "Master Benstent or Sproul?" His flaccid eyelids bunched into creases as his eyes turned up to her.
"I'm Milton Sproul."
"And Master Benstent, is he about too?"
"Ham's not here. What's this about?"
Verna bowed her mouth in a nonchalant expression.
We're from the palace and wanted to ask about a tally we were sent. We just need to be sure it's correct and everything is in order.
The bony man turned back to his shovel and stroked the file across the edge.
Tally's correct. We'd not cheat the sisters.
Of course, we weren't suggesting any such thing. It's just that we can't find any record of who it was you buried. We just need to verify the deceased, and then we can authorize payment.
Don't know. Ham done the work and made out the tally. He's an honest man. He wouldn't cheat a thief to get back what was stole from him. He made out the tally and told me to send it over, that's all I know.
I see, Verna shrugged. Then I guess we'll need to see Master Benstent in order to clear this up. Where can we find him?
Sproul took another stroke with his file.
Don't know. Ham was getting on in years. Said he wanted to spend what little time was left to him, being with his daughter and grandchildren. He left to be with them. They live down country somewheres.
He circled his file in the air.
Left his half of the place, such as it is, to me. Left me his half of the work, too. Guess I'll have to take on a younger man to do the digging. I'm getting old myself.
But you must know where he went and about this tally.
Said I don't. He packed up all his things, not that that was much, and bought himself a donkey for the journey, so I reckon it must be a goodly distance.
He pointed his file over his shoulder toward the south.
Like I said, down country. The last thing he told me was to be sure I sent the tally to the palace, because he had done the work and it was only fair that they pay for what was done. I asked him where to send the payment, as he'd done the work, but he said to use it to hire a new man. Said it was only fair, what with him leaving me on such short notice.
Verna considered her options.
I see. She watched him take a dozen strokes on his shovel and then turned to Warren. Go outside and wait for me.
What? He whispered heatedly.
Why do you...
Verna held up a finger to silence him.
Do as I say. Take a little walk around the area to be sure our friends aren't looking for us.
She leaned a little closer with a meaningful look.
They might be wondering if we need any assistance.
Warren straightened and glanced to the man filing his shovel.
Oh. Yes, all right. I'll go look and see where our friends have gotten to.
He fumbled with a silver brocade on his sleeve.
You won't be long, will you?
No, I'll be out shortly. Go on now and see if you see them anywhere.
After Verna heard the front door shut, Sproul glanced over his shoulder.
Answer's still the same. I told you what.
Verna produced a gold coin in her fingers.
Now, Master Sproul, you and I are going to have a candid conversation. What's more, you are going to answer my questions truthfully.
He frowned suspiciously.
Why'd you send him out?
She no longer made an effort to show him a pleasant smile.
The boy has a weak stomach.
He took an unconcerned stroke with his file.
I told you the truth. If you want to lie, then just tell me and I'll build you one to fit.
Verna shot him a menacing scowl.
Don't you even think of lying to me. You may have told the truth, but not all the truth there is to tell. Now you are going to tell me the rest of it. Either in exchange for this token of my appreciation,
Verna used her hand to snatch the file from his hand and send it sailing up into the air until it vanished from sight,
or in appreciation for my sparing you any unpleasantness.
Whistling with speed, the file streaked out of the sky to slam into the ground, burying itself a scant inch from the gravedigger's toes. Only the tang stuck above the dirt, and that glowed red. With angry mental effort, she drew the hot steel up in a long, thin line of molten metal. Its white-hot glow illuminated his shocked expression, and she, too, could feel the sizzling heat on her face. His eyes had gone wide. She waggled a finger, and the ductile line of glowing steel wavered before his eyes, dancing in time with her finger's movement. She swirled her finger, and the hot steel coiled around the man, holding mere inches from his flesh.
One twitch of my finger, Master Sproul, and I bind you up in your file.
She opened her hand, holding her palm up. A howl of flame ignited, hovering obediently in the air.
After I have you bound up, then I will start at your feet, and I'll cook you an inch at a time until you give me the whole truth.
His crooked teeth chattered.
Please.
She brought the coin up in her other hand and showed him a humorless smile.
Or, as I say, you can choose to tell me the truth in exchange for this token of my appreciation.
He swallowed, eyeing the hot metal around him and the hissing flame in her hand.
It seems I do recall some more of it. I'd be most pleased if you'd let me set the story straight with the rest I'm now remembering.
Verna extinguished the flame above her hand, and with an abrupt effort, flipped the Han's heat to its opposite, to bitter cold. The glow left the metal like a candle's flame being snuffed. The steel went from red-hot to icy black and shattered, the fragments dropping around the stiff gravedigger like hail. Verna lifted his hand and pressed the gold into it, closing his fingers around the coin.
"I'm so sorry. I seem to have broken your file. This will more than cover it, I'm sure."
He nodded. It was likely more gold than the man could earn in a year.
"I've got more files. It's nothing."
She laid a hand on his shoulder.
"All right, Master Sprawl. Why don't you tell me what else you remember about this tally?"
She tightened her grip. "Every last bit of it, no matter how unimportant you consider it, understand?" He licked his lips.
"Yes, I'll tell you every bit, just like I said. Ham did the work. I didn't know nothing about it. Said he had some digging to do for the palace, but nothing more. Ham's the closed-mouth sort, and I never paid it no mind. Right after, he broke it on me, real sudden-like, that he was quitting and going off to live with his daughter, just like I told you. He was always talking about going to live with his daughter before he had to dig his own hole, but he didn't have no money, and she's no better off, so I never paid him no mind. Then he bought that donkey, a good one, too, so I knew he weren't mooning this time. He said he didn't want the money from the work for the palace, said to hire a new man to help me. Well, the next night, before he left, he brought over a bottle of liquor. Good stuff, what cost more than the bottles we always bought. Ham never could keep a secret from me when he gets to drinking. Everyone knows the truth of that. He don't tell what he shouldn't to others, understand. He's a man to be trusted, but he'll tell me everything if he's been drinking."
Verna took her hand back. "I understand. Ham is a good man and your friend. I don't want you to worry about betraying a confidence, Milton. I'm a sister. You aren't doing wrong to confide in me. And you need not fear I will bring trouble to you for it." He nodded, clearly relieved, and managed a weak smile.
"Well, like I said, we had that bottle and we was talking old times. He was leaving and I knew I'd be missing him. You know, we was together for a long time. Not that we didn't."
"You were friends, I understand. What did he say?"
He loosened his collar.
"Well, we was drinking and feeling all misty-eyed about breaking up. That bottle was stronger than what we was used to. I asked him where his daughter lived so I could send him the pay from the tally to help out with things. I got this place after all, and I'd get by. I got work. But Ham says no, he don't need it." "Don't need it? Well, I was powerful curious after he said that. I asked him where he got money, and he said he saved it. Ham never saved nothing. If he had it, it was because he just got it, that's all, and hadn't spent it yet. Well, that's when he told me to be sure to send the tally to the palace. He was real insistent, I guess because he felt bad about leaving me with no help. So I asks him, 'Ham, who'd you put in the ground for the palace?'"
Milton leaned toward her, lowering his voice to a gravelly whisper.
"Didn't put no one in the ground, Ham says. I took him out."
Verna snatched the man's dirty collar.
"What? He dug someone up. Is that what he meant? He dug someone up?"
Milton nodded.
"That's it. Have you ever heard of such a thing? Digging up the dead? Putting them in the ground don't bother me, it's what I do, but the idea of digging them up gives me the shivers. Seems a desecration. Of course, at the time, we was drinking to old times and all, and we was in stitches over it."
Verna's mind was racing in every direction at once.
"Who did he exhume, and on whose orders?"
"All he said was for the palace."
"How long ago?"
"A good long time. I don't remember. Wait, it was after the winter solstice, not long after, maybe just a couple of days."
She shook him by the collar.
"Who was it? Who did he dig up?"
I asked him who it were they wanted back. He told me, he says, they didn't care who. I'm just to bring him, wrapped up all pretty in clean winding sheets."
Verna worked her fingers on his collar.
"Are you sure? You were drinking. He might have just been making up drunken stories."
He shook his head as if he feared she were going to bite it off.
"No, I swear, Ham don't make up stories or lie when he drinks. When he drinks, he would tell me anything true. No matter what sin he done, when he drinks, he confesses it to me true. And I remember what he told me. It was the last night I saw my friend. I remember what he said. He said to be sure to get the tally to the palace, but to wait a few weeks as they was busy, they'd told him."
"What did he do with the body? Where did he take it? Who did he give it to?"
Milton tried to back away a bit, but her grip on his collar didn't allow it.
I don't know. He said he took him to the palace in a cart covered over real good, and he said they give him a special pass so as the guards wouldn't check his load.
He had to dress in his best clothes so people wouldn't recognize him for what he was, so as not to frighten the fine people at the palace, and especially so as not to upset the delicate sensibilities of the sisters who were communing with the Creator. He said he'd done as he was told, and he was proud that he'd done it right, because no one got disturbed by his going there with the bodies. That's all he said about it. I don't know no more. I swear it on my hope to go to the Creator's light after this life be done.
Bodies. You said bodies. More than one. She fixed him with a dangerous glare as she tightened her grip. How many? How many bodies did he dig up and deliver to the palace?
Two.
Two, she repeated in a whisper, wide-eyed. He nodded. Verna's hand fell away from his collar. Two. Two bodies, wrapped in clean winding sheets. Her fists tightened as she growled in rage. Milton swallowed, holding up a hand.
One other thing. I don't know if it matters.
What? She asked through gritted teeth.
He said that they wanted him fresh, and one was small and weren't too bad, but the other gave him a time 'cause he were a big one. I didn't think to ask him more about it. I'm sorry.
With great effort, she managed a smile. Thank you, Milton. You've been a great help to the Creator. He scrunched his shirt closed at the neck.
Thank you, sister. Sister, I've never had the nerve to go to the palace, being what I am and all. I know folks don't like to see me around. Well, I've never gone. Sister, could you give me the Creator's blessing?
Of course, Milton. You have done his work. He closed his eyes with a murmured prayer. Verna gently touched his forehead. The Creator's blessing on his child, she whispered, as she let the warmth of her hand flow into his mind. He gasped in rapture. Verna let her hand seep through his mind. You will remember nothing of what Ham told you about the tally while you were drinking. You will recall only that he said he did the work, but you know nothing of its nature. After I've left, you will not recall my visit. His eyes rolled beneath his eyelids for a time before coming open at last.
Thank you, sister.
Warren was pacing on the street outside. She stormed past him without stopping to say anything. He ran to catch up. Verna was a thunderhead.
I'll strangle her, she growled under her breath. I'll strangle her with my bare hands. I don't care if the keeper takes me, I'll have her throat in my hands.
What are you talking about? What did you find out? Verna, slow down.
Don't talk to me right now, Warren. Don't say a word.
She swept through the streets, her fists whipping in time to her furious strides, a storm rampaging across the land. The churning knot of fury in her stomach threatened to ignite in lightning. She didn't see the streets or buildings or hear the drums thundering in the background. She forgot Warren trotting behind her. She could see nothing but a vision of vengeance. She was blind to where she was, lost in a world of rage. Without knowing how she had gotten there, she found herself crossing one of the back bridges onto Halsband Island. In the center crest above the river, she stamped to a halt so abruptly that Warren almost collided with her. She snatched the silver braiding at his collar. You get yourself down into the vaults and link up that prophecy. What are you talking about? She shook him by his robes.
The one that says that when the prelate and the prophet are given to the light in a sacred rite, the flames will bring to boil a cauldron of guile and give ascension to a false prelate, who will reign over the death of the palace of the prophets. Find the branches, link it up, find out everything you can. Do you understand?
Warren snatched his robes free and tugged them straight.
What's this about? What did the gravedigger tell you?
She held up a cautionary finger.
Not now, Warren.
We're supposed to be friends, Verna. We're in this together, remember? I want to know. Her voice was thunder on the horizon.
Do as I tell you. If you press me right now, Warren, you are going to go for a swim. Now, go link up that prophecy, and as soon as you find anything, you come tell me.
Verna knew about the prophecies in the vaults. She knew that it could easily take years to link branches. It could take centuries. What choice was there? He brushed dust from his robes, giving his eyes an excuse to look elsewhere.
As you wish, prelate.
As he turned to go, she could see that his eyes were red and puffy. She wanted to catch his arm and stop him, but he was already too far away. She wanted to call out to him and tell him that she wasn't angry at him. It wasn't his fault that she was the false prelate, but her voice failed her. She found the round rock beneath the limb and sprang up the wall. Bothering with only two branches on the pear tree,
She dropped to the ground inside the prelate's compound, and when she regained her feet, started running. Panting and hurt, she slapped her hand repeatedly against the door to the prelate's sanctuary, but it wouldn't open. Remembering why, she dug in her pocket and found the ring. Inside, she pressed it against the sunburst on the door to close it, and then, with all her anger and anguish, heaved the ring across the room, hearing it clatter against the walls and skitter across the floor. Verna pried the journey book from the secret pouch sewn in the back of her belt and plopped down on the three-legged stool. Gasping for her breath, she fumbled the stylus from the spine of the little black book. She opened it, spreading it flat on the small table, and stared at the blank page. She tried to think through the rage and resentment. She had to consider the possibility that she could be wrong. No, she wasn't wrong. Still, she was a sister of the light, for what that was worth, and knew better than to risk everything on presumption. She had to think of a way to verify who had the other book, and she also had to do it in a way that wouldn't betray her identity if she was wrong. But she wasn't wrong. She knew who had it. Verna kissed her ring finger as she whispered a prayer beseeching the Creator's guidance, and asking, too, for strength. She wanted to vent her wrath, but before all else, she had to make sure. With trembling fingers, she picked up the stylus and began to write. "You must first tell me the reason you chose me the last time. I remember every word, one mistake, and this journey book feeds the fire." Verna closed the book and tucked it back into its secret pouch in her belt. Shaking, she pulled the comforter from its resting place atop the box bench and dragged it to the overstuffed chair. Feeling more lonely than she had ever felt in her entire life, she curled up in the chair. Verna remembered her last meeting with Prelate Annalena, when Verna had returned with Richard after all those years. Annalena hadn't wanted to see her, and it had taken weeks to finally be granted an audience. As long as she lived, no matter how many hundreds of years that might be, she would never forget that meeting, or the things the prelate had told her. Verna had been furious to discover the prelate had withheld valuable information. The prelate had used her and never told her the reasons. The prelate had asked if Verna knew why she had been selected to go after Richard. Verna said she had thought it was a vote of confidence. The prelate said it was because she suspected that sisters Grace and Elizabeth, who had been on the journey with her and had been the first two to be selected, were sisters of the dark, and she had privileged information from prophecy that said the first two sisters would die. The prelate said she had used her prerogative to pick Verna as the third sister to go. Verna asked, "You chose me because you had faith that I was not one of them?" "I chose you, Verna," the prelate said, "because you were far down on the list, and because, all in all, you are quite unremarkable. I doubted you were one of them. You are a person of little note. I'm sure Grace and Elizabeth made their way to the top of the list, because whoever directs the Sisters of the Dark considered them expendable. I direct the Sisters of the Light. I chose you for the same reason. There are sisters who are valuable to our cause. I could not risk one of them on such a task. The boy may prove of value to us, but he is not as important as other matters at the palace. It was simply an opportunity I thought to take. If there had been trouble, and none of you made it back, well, I'm sure you can understand that a general would not want to lose his best troops on a low-priority mission." The woman who had smiled at her when she was little, filling her with inspiration, had broken her heart. Verna drew the comforter up as she blinked at the watery walls of the sanctuary. All she had ever wanted was to be a sister of the light. She had wanted to be one of those wondrous women who used her gift to do the Creator's work here in this world. She had given her life and her heart to the Palace of the Prophets. Verna remembered the day they came and told her that her mother had died. Old age, they said. Her mother didn't have the gift, and so was of no use to the palace. Her mother didn't live close, and Verna only rarely saw her. When her mother did travel to the palace for a visit, she was frightened because Verna didn't age to her eyes the way a normal person aged. She could never understand it, no matter how many times Verna tried to explain the spell. Verna knew it was because her mother feared to really listen. She feared magic. Though the sisters made no attempt to conceal the existence of the spell about the palace that slowed their aging, people without the gift had difficulty fathoming it. It was magic that had no meaning to their lives. The people were proud to live near the palace, near its splendor and might, and although they viewed the palace with reverence, that reverence was edged with fearful caution. They didn't dare to focus their minds on things of such power, much the same way as they enjoyed the warmth of the sun but didn't dare to stare at it. When her mother died, Verna had been at the palace for 47 years, yet appeared to have aged only to adolescence. Verna remembered the day they came and told her that Lytis, her daughter, had died. Old age, they said. Verna's daughter, Jedediah's daughter, didn't have the gift, and so was of no use to the palace. It would be better, they said, if she were raised by a family who would love her and give her a normal life. A life at the palace was no life for one without the gift. Verna had the creator's work to do, and so acquiesced. Joining the gift of the male and the female created a better, though still remote, chance of the offspring being born with the gift. Thus, sisters and wizards could look forward to approval, if not official encouragement, should they conceive a child. As per the arrangement the palace always made in such circumstances, Lytis didn't know that the people who raised her weren't her real parents. Verna guessed it was for the best. What kind of mother could a sister of the light be? The palace had provided for the family, to ensure Verna wouldn't worry for her daughter's well-being. Several times Verna had visited, as a sister merely bringing the Creator's blessing to a family of honest, hard-working people, and Lytis had seemed happy. The last time Verna had visited, Lytis had been gray and stooped, and was able to walk only with the aid of a cane. Lytis didn't remember Verna as the same sister who had visited when she was playing catch the fox with her young friends 60 years before. Lytis had smiled at Verna, at the blessing, and said, "Thank you, sister. So talented for one so young. How are you, Lytis? Have you a good life?" Verna's daughter smiled distantly. "Oh, sister, I've had a long and happy life. My husband died 5 years ago, but other than that, the Creator has blessed me." She had chuckled. "I only wish I still had my curly brown hair. It was once as lovely as yours. Yes, it was, I swear it." Dear Creator, how long had it been since Lytis had passed on? It had to be 50 years. Lytis had had children, but Verna had scrupulously avoided learning so much as their names. The lump in her throat as she wept was nearly choking her. She had given so much to be a sister. She had just wanted to help people. She had never asked for anything. And she had been played a fool. She hadn't wanted to be prelate, but she was just beginning to think she could use the post to better the lives of people, to do the work for which she had sacrificed everything. Instead, she was again being played for a fool. Verna clutched the comforter to herself as she cried in racking sobs, until the light was long gone from the little windows in the peaks and her throat was raw. In the heart of the night, she finally decided to go to her bed. She didn't want to stay in the prelate's sanctuary. It only seemed to be mocking her. She was not the prelate. She had finally exhausted all her tears and felt only numb humiliation. She couldn't get the door to open, and had to crawl around on the floor until she found the prelate's ring. After she had closed the door, she put the ring back on her finger, a reminder, a beacon of the dupe she was. She shuffled woodenly into the prelate's office, on her way to the prelate's bed. The candle had guttered and gone out, so she lit another on the desk, still stacked with waiting reports. Phoebe worked hard at seeing to it that it stayed that way. What was Phoebe going to think when she found out that she wasn't really the prelate's administrator, that she had been appointed by a quite unremarkable sister of little note? Tomorrow, she would have to apologize to Warren. This wasn't his fault. She shouldn't take it out on him. Just before she went through the door to the outer office, she stopped in her tracks. Her diaphanous shield was shredded. She looked back at the desk. No new reports had been added to the piles. Someone had been snooping around. Chapter 26. Sheets of rain raked the deck of the ship. The barefoot men crouched, tense and ready, their bulging muscles glistening in the faint yellow lamplight, as they watched the distance close, and then, with a sudden burst of effort, they leapt into the darkness. After they landed, they sprang up to catch the lead-weighted fists at the ends of light heaving lines lofted across the murky chasm after them. Hand over hand, the men hauled across the heavy docking lines attached to the heaving lines. Moving with swift efficiency, they looped the wrist-thick dock lines around the massive pilings, planted their feet, and bent their backs against the drag, using the pilings for purchase. Wet wood creaked and groaned as the lines took up the tension. The rows of men straining against the burden gave ground until they brought the slow but seemingly inexorable headway of the Lady Sepha to a halt. Grunting in unison, they began taking back the ground they had yielded, and the ship slowly drew toward the rain-slicked pier, as men aboard dropped bundled rope fenders over the side to protect the hull. Sister Eulysia, bunched together with sisters Toby, Cecilia, Armina, Nikki, and Marissa, under a tarp drumming in the pelting rain, watched as Captain Blake paced the deck, angrily shouting orders at men running to see them carried out. He hadn't wanted to bring the Lady Sepha into the narrow wharf in such weather, to say nothing of the dark, but instead to anchor in the harbor and bring the women ashore in the longboat. Ulyssia was in no mood to be drenched as they were rowed a half mile to shore, and had summarily dismissed his pleas about having to launch all the boats to tow the ship in with the sweeps. One glare had cut off his reiteration of the dangers and sent him tight-lipped to the task. The captain snatched his sodden hat from his head as he stopped before them.
"We'll have you ashore shortly, ladies."
"It didn't appear as difficult as you made it out to be, Captain," Ulyssia said. He wrung his hat.
"We got her in, though why you'd want to come way down the coast to Graffin Harbor is beyond me. Getting back to Tanamura over land from this forsaken army post is not going to be the ease it would have been had you let us take you straight there by sea."
He left unsaid that it would have had them off his ship days sooner, which was undoubtedly the reason he had offered, with effusive graciousness, to take them straight back to Tanamura as they had originally wanted. Ulyssia would have liked nothing better, but she had had no choice in the matter. She had done as she was ordered. She peered up beyond the wharf to where she knew he waited. Her companion's eyes, too, stared into the same darkness. The hills overlooking the harbor were visible only in the crackling flashes of lightning, appearing suddenly out of the void, and except when the lightning sporadically revealed the lay of the high ground, the feeble glow of lights coming from the massive stone fortress hunkered high on a distant hill appeared to be floating in the inky sky. Only in the brief illumination could she see the bleak, rain-slicked stone walls. Jagang was there. Being before him in the dream was one thing, she could eventually wake, but being before him in the flesh was quite another. There would be no waking now. She clutched the link tighter to herself. For Jagang, there was going to be no waking either. Her true master would have him and make him pay.
"Looks like you're expected."
Ulyssia snatched herself from her thoughts and redirected her attention to the captain.
"What?"
He pointed with his hat.
"That coach must be for you ladies. There sure enough isn't anyone else about but all those soldiers."
Staring off into the gloom, she finally saw the black coach with its team of six huge geldings, waiting on the road at the top of the wall above the wharf. Its door stood open. Ulyssia had to remind herself to let the breath go from her lungs. It would be over soon. Jagang would pay. They had only to see it through. Once her eyes had recognized the still, dark shapes, she was able to begin picking out soldiers. They were everywhere. Fires dotted the closer hills all about the harbor, and she knew that for every fire that managed to burn in the pouring rain, there were 20 or 30 that wouldn't catch flame. Without counting the fires she could see, she could easily tell there were hundreds. The gangway rumbled across the deck as the sailors slid it out through the opening in the bulwark. With a dull thud, one end dropped on the dock. As soon as it touched down, sailors trotted down the plank with the sisters' baggage and headed up the pier toward the coach.
"It's been a pleasure doing business with you, sister,"
Captain Blake lied. He fumbled with his hat as he waited for them to be on their way. He turned to the men on the lines.
"Stand ready to slip the lines, lads. We don't want to lose the tide."
No cheer went up, but only because they feared the result, were they to show their happiness to be rid of their passengers. On their sea voyage back to the old world, it had been necessary to measure out a few more lessons in discipline, lessons not one of them would ever forget. As they waited silently for the order to cast off, none of the sailors so much as glanced at the six women. At the end of the gangway, four men stood in readiness, eyes fixed on the ground, each gripping a pole supporting the corner of a canvas tarp to hold over the sisters' heads to keep them from being drenched. With as much power as was crackling around Ulyssia and her five companions, she could easily have used the Han to shield herself and her five sisters from the rain, but she didn't want to use the link until it was time. She didn't want to take a chance by giving Jagang any warning. Besides, it pleased her to make these insignificant worms carry the tarp over their heads. They were all lucky she didn't want to reveal the link, or she would have slaughtered the lot of them. Slowly, as Ulyssia started moving, she could feel each of her sisters move too. Each of them had not only the gift they were born with, the female Han, but each had been through the ritual, and each also possessed its opposite, the male Han they had appropriated from young wizards. Besides the additive gift they were born with, each also possessed its opposite, subtractive magic. And now it was all linked. Ulyssia had not been sure it would work. Sisters of the Dark, and beyond that, Sisters of the Dark who had also succeeded in absorbing the male Han, had never before attempted to link their power. It had been a dangerous risk, but the alternative was unacceptable. That it worked had given them all a heady flush of relief. That it had worked beyond their wildest hopes left Ulyssia intoxicated with the swift and violent flux of magic coursing through her. She had never suspected such awesome power could be gathered. Short of the Creator or the Keeper, there was no power on the face of the earth that could approach what they now controlled. Ulyssia was the Link's dominant node, and the one who would command and direct the Force. It was all she could do to contain the inner blaze of Han. Wherever her gaze settled, it howled to be released. Soon enough it would be. Linked as they were, the female and male Han, the additive and subtractive magic, they had enough destructive force to make Wizard's Fire seem a candle by comparison. With a mere thought, she could level the hill atop which sat the fortress. With a mere thought, she could instantly level everything in the range of her sight and possibly beyond. If she could be sure Jigang was in the fortress, she would have already unleashed the cataclysmic fury. But if he wasn't, and they failed to find and kill him before they fell asleep again, then he would have them. First, they must face him, to be sure he was there. And then she would release such power as had never been seen in this world, and turn Jigang to dust before he could blink. Her master would have his soul then, and see to it that Jigang's punishment went on without end. At the end of the gangway, the four sailors moved around them, sheltering them from the rain. Ulyssia could feel the muscles in each of her sisters flex as they moved up the pier. Through the link, she could feel each little ache or pain or pleasure they felt. In her mind, they were one. In her mind, they were of one thought, one need, to rid themselves of this leech of a man.
"Soon enough, sisters, soon enough. And then we go after the Seeker." "Yes, sisters, and then we go after the Seeker."
As they marched up the pier, a squad of grisly-looking soldiers trotted past in the opposite direction, their weapons clanging as they went. They ran up the slippery gangway without pause. The squad's corporal came to a halt before the blustering ship's captain. She couldn't hear the soldiers' words, but she saw Captain Blake throw his arms up, and she could hear him scream.
"What?"
The captain angrily threw down his hat and started a flurry of objections she couldn't make out. Had she extended the link, she would be able to, but she didn't dare risk it yet. The soldiers drew steel. Captain Blake planted his fists on his hips and, after a short pause, turned to the men on the dock.
"Make the lines fast, boys," he yelled down at them. "We're not leaving tonight."
When Ulyssia reached the coach, a soldier held his hand out, commanding them to enter. Ulyssia let the others climb in first. She could feel the comfort of the weight coming off the legs of the two older women as they sat on the thinly padded leather seat. The soldier ordered the four sailors that had accompanied them to stand to the side and wait. As she stepped in and pulled the door closed, Ulyssia saw the soldiers on the ship, herding all the sailors from the latest Sepha down the gangway. Emperor Jigang probably intended to kill them to eliminate any witnesses to connect him with Sisters of the Dark. Jigang was doing her a favor. He would not get the chance to kill the ship's crew, of course, but since the sailors were not being allowed to leave, she would. She smiled at her sisters. Through the link, they each knew her thoughts. Each of the other five returned a satisfied smile. Their sea voyage had been miserable. The sailors would pay. On the slow ride to the fortress, as they gained a rise, Ulyssia was surprised to see, when the lightning flashed, the extent of the army Jigang had gathered. Every time the lightning thundered through the hills, she could see tents as far as there was land. They covered the rolling hills like blades of grass in spring. Their numbers made the city of Tanimura seem a village. She had not known there were this many men-at-arms in the whole of the old world. Well, perhaps they, too, would be useful. When the forks of lightning ripped under the boiling clouds and shook the ground, she could see, too, the grim fortress where Jigang waited. Through the link, she could see the fortress through their eyes, too, and could feel their fear. They all wanted to blast that hilltop into oblivion, but every one of them knew that they couldn't, not yet. There would be no mistaking Jigang when they saw him. None of them could fail to recognize that smirking face, but they had to see him first to be certain.
"When we see him, sisters, and know he is there, then he will die."
Ulyssia wanted to see fear in that man's eyes, the kind of fear he had put in their hearts, but she dared not risk giving him any indication of what they were about to do. Ulyssia didn't know what he was capable of. They had, after all, never before been visited in the dream that was not a dream by any but their master, the Keeper. And she was not about to take the slightest chance by giving him any warning just for the satisfaction of seeing him quake. She had deliberately waited until they were sailing into Grafen Harbor before she revealed her plan to her sisters, just to be safe. Their master would see to Jigang's punishment. It was their job to simply deliver his soul to the underworld and into the Keeper's grasp. The Keeper would be more than pleased when they restored his power in this world, and would reward them with a view of Jigang's torment should they wish it, and they would wish it. The coach lurched to a halt before the imposing maw of the fortress. The women were ordered out of the coach by a burly soldier wearing a hide mantle and enough weapons to single-handedly slaughter a good-sized army. The six of them marched silently through the rain and mud and in under the barreled roof beyond the iron portcullis. They were led into a dark entryway where they were told to stand and wait, as if any of them had any intention of sitting on the filthy, cold stone floor. They were, after all, wearing their finest dresses. Tovey in a dark dress, slimming to her size. Cecilia, her brushed and neat gray hair complementing her deep green dress, banded with lace at the collar. Nikki in a simple dress, black, as her dresses always were, laced at the bodice in a way that accented the shape of her bosom. Marissa in a red dress, a color she favored, and with good reason, the way it set off her thick mane of dark hair, to say nothing of exhibiting her exquisite form. Armina in a dark blue dress that revealed her reasonably shapely figure and went well with her sky-blue eyes. And Ulyssia, in her own becoming attire, a shade of blue much lighter than Armina's, and trimmed with tasteful ruffles at her cleavage and wrists, and unadorned at the waist so as not to hide her well-formed hips. They all wanted to look their best when they killed Jigang. The black stone walls of the room were bare of everything but two hissing torches in brackets. As they waited, Ulyssia could feel the anger of each of the others rising, along with hers, and, too, their collective apprehension. When the sailors, surrounded by soldiers, came through the portcullis, one of the two guards in the stone room opened the inner door into the fortress, and with a rude tilt of his head ordered the sisters through. The corridors were as austere as the entry room had been. This was an armed fortress, not a palace, after all, and it made no pretension of comfort. As they followed their guards, Ulyssia saw no more than crude wooden benches and torches set in rusty iron brackets. Doors were rough planks with iron strap hinges, and there was not so much as a single oil lamp to be seen as they worked their way into the heart of the stronghold. It appeared little more than barracks for troops. The guards came to a large double door and turned their backs to the stone at each side after opening the doors. One of them pompously lifted a thumb, ordering them into the great room beyond. Ulyssia vowed to her sisters that she would remember his face, and he would pay the price for his arrogance. Ulyssia led the other five women in as the sailors came up the hall behind, accompanied by the echo of boots on stone and the clatter of the weapons of the men guarding them. The room was huge. Windows without glass, high up on the walls, revealed the lightning outside and let the rain run down the dark stone in glistening rivulets. A pit to each side of the floor held roaring fires. Their sparks and churning smoke ascended to billow out the open windows, but still left a reeking haze to hang in the air. In a ring of rusted brackets around the room, torches spit and hissed, adding the smell of pitch to the stink of sweat. Everything in the dim room flickered in the firelight. Between the twin crackling fires they could see in the gloom beyond a massive plank table set with a wealth of food. Only one man sat at the table, on the opposite side, casually watching them as he sawed off a chunk of roasted suckling pig. In the murky, flickering light it was hard to be sure. They had to be sure. Behind the table against the wall stood a row of people who were obviously not soldiers. The men wore white trousers and nothing else. The women wore baggy-legged garments, running from ankle to neck to wrist and cinched at the waist with a white cord. Except for the cord, the outfits were so sheer that the barefoot women might as well have been naked. The man raised his hand and waggled his first two fingers, ordering them forward. The six women advanced across the cavernous room, that because of its dark stone that swallowed the firelight seemed to close in about them. On an enormous bearskin before the table sat two more of the absurdly clad slaves. The women behind the table against the wall stood hands at their sides, bodies stiff and unmoving. Each of the young women had a gold ring pierced through the center of her lower lip. The fires behind them popped and snapped as the six sisters advanced into the gloom. One of the men in white trousers poured wine into a mug for the man when he held it out to his side. None of the slaves looked at the six women. Their attention was on the man sitting alone at the table. Ulyssia and her sisters all recognized him now. Jigang. He was of average height, but stout, with massive arms and chest. His bare shoulders bulged from a fur vest opened in the middle, displaying a few dozen gold and jeweled chains lying against the hair in the deep cleft between his prodigious chest muscles. The chains and jewels looked to have once belonged to kings and queens. Silver bands encircled his arms above bulky biceps. Each of his thick fingers bore a gold or silver ring. Each of the sisters knew well the pain those powerful fingers could inflict. His shaved head gleamed in the fluttering firelight. It matched his brawn. Ulyssia couldn't imagine him with hair atop his head. It could only diminish his menace. His neck looked like it belonged to a bull. A gold ring in the flare of his left nostril held a thin gold chain running to another ring at mid-height in his left ear. He was clean-shaven except for a 2-inch braid of mustache growing only above the corners of his smirk, and another braid in the center under his lower lip. His eyes, though, were what riveted anyone upon whom they settled. There were no whites to them at all. They were a murky gray, clouded over with sullen, dusky shapes that shifted in a field of inky obscurity. Yet there was no doubt whatsoever as to when he was looking at you. They were twin windows into nightmare. The smirk departed, leaving in its place a treacherous glare.
"You're late," he said in a deep, grating voice that they each recognized as readily as his nightmare eyes.
Ulyssia wasted no time with a reply, nor did she betray any indication of what she was about to do. Twisting the flow of Han, she even controlled their hatred, allowing only one facet of their feelings, fear, to touch their faces, lest they give him any warning of their confidence and betray a reason for it. Ulyssia committed to obliterating everything from her toes outward for the next 20 miles. With violent and unceremonious abruptness, she yanked the restraining blocks from the furious force bottled behind it. As quick as thought, with thundering fury, the additive and subtractive magic exploded outward in a murderous blast. The very air howled as it burned. The room ignited with a blinding flash of twin magics, opposites that twisted in a deafening discharge of wrath. Even Ulyssia was stunned at what she had unleashed. The fabric of reality seemed to rip. Her last thought was that surely she had destroyed the entire world. Chapter 27. Like snowflake patches of a dark dream drifting down, everything came slowly back into her vision. The twin fires first, then the torches, then the dark stone walls, and finally the people. Her whole body was numb for a stunned moment before the feeling returned to her flesh in a million painful pinpricks. She hurt everywhere. Jagang tore off a big bite of roast pheasant. He chewed a moment and then wagged the leg bone at her.
"You know your problem, Ulyssia," he asked, still chewing. "You use magic that you can unleash as quick as a thought."
Smirk returned to his greasy lips.
"I, on the other hand, am a dreamwalker. I use the time between fragments of thought, in that stillness when there is nothing, to do what I do. I slip in where no other can go."
He gestured with the bone again as he swallowed.
"You see, for me, in that space between thought, time is infinite, and I can do as I wish. You might as well be stone statues trying to chase me."
Ulyssia felt her sisters through the link. It was still there.
"Crude, very crude," he said. "I've seen others do it much better, but then they'd been practiced at it. I left the link, for now. For now, I want you all to feel each other. I'll break it later. Just as I can break the link, I can break your minds, too."
He took a gulp of wine.
"But I think that's so unproductive. How can you teach people a lesson, really teach them a lesson, if their minds don't understand it?"
Through the link, Ulyssia felt Cecilia lose control of her bladder and the warm urine running down her legs.
"How?"
Ulyssia heard herself ask in a hollow voice.
"How can you use the time between thoughts?"
Jagang picked up his knife and sliced off a slab of meat on an ornate silver platter to his side. He stabbed the bloody center of the slice with the knife point and then rested his elbows on the table.
"What are we all?"
he waved around the skewered hunk of meat as it dripped red down his knife.
"What is reality, the reality of our existence?"
He drew the meat off the knife with his teeth and chewed as he went on.